I'm your host, Paul Essen, and I'm joined by my regular contributors, Travis Hudson.
Good thing I didn't just grab my beer to introduce myself.
And Andrew Riley.
I feel like I should crack my second beer open right now just because you said that.
Well, this new intro is working out swell. So we're going to try something a little new today. We are going to try a grab bag, variety pack, whatever you want to call it, of topics that we're just going to all talk about and see if any of them catch on. Andrew, I think you have our first topic up, and you're drinking a beer. What are you doing? You're not prepared for this. We went over this right before.
Yeah, I can talk. I can talk and drink at the same time. That's what we're doing here. We're going to talk and drink at the same time.
All right.
I drink and I know things, and I talk about them occasionally.
Those are your three specialties.
So what we're going to spend a little time talking about is something that Paul and I have spent time talking about already, and see if we can extend this a little bit further. I am a member of Xbox Game Pass, and have been for a while, and due to their very generous conversion package last E3, will be for some time into the future. And Paul also plays games on Game Pass, but Travis does not. So we have a lot of things we could talk about around the economics of Game Pass from the consumer's point, the economics of Game Pass from the developer's and publisher's standpoint, the economics of Game Pass from Microsoft's perspective, and how it works both for Paul as a more casual gamer, me as a very avid gamer, especially in the Xbox sphere, and Travis as not so much a Game Pass player. Not having a membership and not really playing much Xbox these days. There's actually a lot of ground to cover here because it's a surprisingly successful program. I think that everyone agrees that the idea of the Netflix of gaming has been a thing that has been a holy grail for the industry for a while, and a lot of people have tried to do it. Apple has got their Apple Arcade, Google is trying it with Stadia, but Microsoft's Game Pass seems to be the one that is having the most success. And I want to talk about that from that perspective, but also, you know, do you guys agree with me? Do you feel that way? Or is it because I'm so invested in that ecosystem already that it feels more like success to me than something like Apple Arcade, because I don't do Apple Arcade as much?
I guess it kind of depends on your definition of success. I'm also mostly an Xbox gamer. I don't have an iPhone, so I have no interest in Apple Arcade. I don't play a ton of mobile games, so I don't have, I think Google Play also has a similar Apple Arcade type thing.
Yes, Google Play does, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I probably have the same bias. I don't know, monetarily, I'm sure Apple Arcade is probably the most successful just because Apple's got lots of fans that have their iPhones and everything. But I think, yeah, I mean, I think the transition has been surprisingly smooth for Microsoft and I know it's probably not completely finished yet or even in the middle innings, but it seems like they're successfully convincing people, including you, Mr. I refuse to rent media and want to own everything forever and ever, amen, to transition to this model.
So also, I'll interject here and back up one thing. One step. What exactly is the mechanism of Game Pass?
Yeah, should we explain what this is, or should we just keep diving in?
Because my last experience with anything close to this was the old Games with Gold program. But I gather this is somewhat different.
It's substantially different. Games with Gold still does exist, by the way. Whether it will continue to exist indefinitely into the future is unknown, but Games with Gold is a program that still is going on, and members who have Gold membership can continue to get two free games for Xbox 360 and two free games for Xbox One every month. The Xbox One games in the Games with Gold program are time licenses, in that as long as you're a Gold member, you can continue to play those games, but the Xbox 360 games that they give you are essentially yours, because the licensing on the Xbox 360 doesn't allow for them to say, okay, we're going to take that license back. Once you have the license, you have it. Games with Gold, it doesn't exist on the Xbox 360 specifically. It only exists on the Xbox, I'm sorry, not Games with Gold, Game Pass. It only really exists on the Xbox One and on PC, because those infrastructures have more control over the licenses. And what it does is it gives you a license to play while you are a Game Pass member and while the game is in the Game Pass program. There were 100 or so games when Game Pass launched, and they add to it and take away on a regular basis. So there's 150, 200 games on console, and another 100 or so games, probably more, on PC as well, that you can get with the two different types of Game Pass that they have available. there's the basic Game Pass, which is specifically for the Xbox One console, and it does include some Xbox 360 titles, but only through the backwards compatible system. So if I were to try and play this Game Pass game that I have access to only through Game Pass on my Xbox 360, it would not work because it doesn't have the license. The Xbox One has the license.
So what happens? We might be delving too much into the nitty-gritty details of it, but curiosity, you said they take games away. So if you play like an RPG or anything that has a long timeline on it, and then the game goes away, presumably yep. You still have your saved file, and so then you could go buy the game and keep playing it where you left off, right?
Correct. Okay. That is 100% correct. In addition, they entice you to buy the game by having the game on a permanent sale within the Game Pass system at 20% off. So if you like the game as you're playing it in Game Pass and you think it's not going to be something you finish right away, or you just want to support the developers, you can buy the game, but you get a baked-in 20% discount right from the start.
And that discount goes away if they ever take it off Game Pass.
Correct.
So they're trying to get you to buy it, okay, while it's still there. Okay.
So it is a way of trying out a whole bunch of games that you might not have access to without having to pay up front. So if you want to dabble in a whole bunch of games, you can certainly do that. If you find one you really like, you can say, okay, I paid the fee to try out a whole bunch, but I'm going to buy this one now. Or you can buy the Game Pass subscription and play a bunch of games and complete them and then never buy them. And if you're okay with the fact that it was essentially a rental, then it doesn't matter. Paul was right. I don't like renting my content. And so the fact that Game Pass succeeds for me, even with that bias I have against renting media, is a little bit surprising. And it's partly because of how I handle the Game Pass situation. It's not so much that I am opposed to renting games. It's that I'm opposed to renting games that I want to own. In Game Pass, I'm paying for the privilege of having access to games that I can play without having to own them. The games I don't care about as much. If it's a game I care about, I still want to own it. And maybe that gives me a cheaper price with this program, but most of the time I'm just getting it to play a game that I never would have bought or played otherwise. Something that's not in my wheelhouse, something that's too small, something I never would have even known existed. Because the games that are in there, because they have 100, 150, 200 games, they can include a lot of different games. Sure, there's some bigger stuff, especially anything that's Microsoft published, they're trying to include that. So one of the big games that they recently released was Gears Tactics. Microsoft publishes that, they own the Gears IP, they throw it into Game Pass, and I can play Gears Tactics if I want to, which is pretty cool, because I like tactics games, I just don't play Gears. So I never would have bought it. Never would have bought it.
Yeah, maybe impressed is the wrong word. I was surprised that they offered Gears Tactics as a, available at launch. I think I even got the pre-order bonus when I was, when I started up, I got whatever Thrasher Ball Cole or whatever, I can't remember the name of it, but pretty much on launch day I was able to play that game because I had to your point, they had, I guess maybe I should go back a step, they had this conversion deal that you had mentioned where if you had like Xbox Live with Gold, you could upgrade it to Game Pass for a certain low fee. So anyway, I've got Game Pass for a couple months, maybe even a year plus, and to test drive it. And yeah, there's some good games on there. There's Gears Tactics is on there. Nier Automata, which is pretty universally acclaimed game and still, I think, could command a fairly hefty price if you were to buy it, is available on there. A lot of other games. Indivisible, I ended up playing mostly because it was on Game Pass. It's not a game I would have bought otherwise. They're making a pretty compelling offer for people.
So wait, does Game Pass usurp games with or a gold membership then? You just said that there was some sort of conversion where if you had a gold membership, you could convert it to Game Pass.
They had an offer, and Andrew can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was a limited time offer. You could upgrade your Xbox Gold membership to an Game Pass membership for like a dollar or something along those lines.
But like if I went to Xbox now, there'd be like I could choose between either a gold membership or a Game Pass membership at this
Correct.
Point? Okay.
Yep. So if you had Xbox Live Gold and you could have up to 3 years of this at that time, for $1 you could convert that Xbox Live Gold membership forever length you had left into an Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, which is Xbox Live Gold plus both console Game Pass and PC Game Pass. Console Game Pass costs $10. PC Game Pass costs $5. Game Pass Ultimate, which is both of the Game Passes, PC and console, plus the Xbox Live Gold membership that we were already having, is $15 per month. So they find a way to raise their price tag a little bit, but they give you this huge value add for it. Because one of the reasons that Xbox Live Gold doesn't work for PC gamers is that paying for online services is something that PC gamers balked at. When I first joined Xbox, it was something I balked at. Why am I paying this additional price per month so I can play online with my friends? Why can't I just do that? And the answer is because somebody has to pay for the servers. And the developers aren't paying for the servers. The publishers aren't paying for the servers. Xbox was paying for the servers through Microsoft, so they were charging this fee. Whereas when I play on StarCraft with Paul, not that I do that too often. I'm trying to do this more often, Paul, I promise.
Tomorrow, right?
Yeah, tomorrow. Let's plan on it. See if I can make it.
Sounds good. Not necessarily tomorrow for whoever's listening, because we probably won't be there by then.
Yeah. But that's the Battle.net servers, and Blizzard runs the Battle.net servers. Activision now runs the Battle.net servers. They're paying for that server because it's something that is built into the game that Blizzard has this long history of maintaining. EA runs their own servers, but they shut them down all the time. If you want servers that are up and going to stay up and your game is going to have online connectivity that lasts indefinitely, you need to have a monetary source that pays for it, and Xbox Live Gold does that. That's why we had to pay for it on console, even though it was something that I chafed at when we started. I understand the point of it. And now the fee is being rolled into this Game Pass Ultimate because that's where they really want you to be. They want you to be in that subscription service because the access to the games is enticing to you, but also if it is enticing, you're less likely to leave. I don't think the retention rate is going to be significantly higher than Xbox Live Gold would have been, but I think that the value is there for the consumers. And I think that's one of the things that makes this really interesting is that this is valuable for me as a primary console player. It's valuable for a lot of PC gamers who can come in and say, okay, you know, if they were to do something like this on Steam, have access to a huge number of games on Steam, people would happily pay a fair amount of money for that kind of thing. And Xbox is doing this and saying, okay, we're going to do these games. And the game collection, the PC Game Pass games, include a lot of highly regarded games, like Paul was mentioning about Nier Automata, that commands a $40 price tag still, if it's not on sale. So if you wanted to pay it, you can pay $40 to get your copy of it, or you can pay $15, try it out, say, oh, it doesn't work for me, and then spend the rest of your month playing games that are more interesting to you.
Yeah, and that's a compelling, as somebody who has more times than I would like to count in my life, bought a game, played it once, and been like, oh, that was a terrible mistake, and put it back on the shelf and never touched it again. It's a pretty compelling offer.
So I had a question earlier when Andrew was talking about he didn't like renting media. So yeah, so in the old days, you know, we all had, well, yeah, like you could go to Blockbuster or whatever your local video games
sure.
or video stores. But I'm just curious, you said you don't like renting your media. Were you opposed to it back then? Or is this like a digital transition?
It's definitely more of a digital transition issue. I've always been opposed to it in the concept of long-term rentals. I don't want to rent to own or pretend that I own it and only rent it. I don't like the license software model as it exists.
You don't want to lease a car.
Yeah. Leasing a car is a bad idea for me. It makes a lot of financial sense for a lot of people in a lot of situations, but it's not for me. When I was younger, absolutely, I rented games from the local store. You know, I'd go down to the store and say, oh, they got the new Mega Man. I'll try it out.
You and I probably actually went to the same local store.
Yeah. Try them out. And, you know, that may have been the only way I played a lot of those games. And certainly before my parents were going to throw down $50-$60 to buy me a new game, they wanted to make sure I was going to like it. So they wanted to rent it for themselves and for my benefit as well. And that was, of course, done through the stores. But also, it was done with my friends. You know, my friend gets a new game. Hey, this is pretty cool. And they let me borrow it, and then they pass it back. In Game Pass, I've had a conversation with Paul on many occasions where I'm playing this cool game. It's in Game Pass. You should try it out. And it's like I'm lending him a copy in a certain way.
Yeah, I still haven't tried Slay the Spire yet. Sorry. I've downloaded it. I've installed it.
Progress.
Yeah. One step closer.
Yeah, Kindle has some way to lend out. You can lend your ebook to somebody somehow, right?
Yes.
That wouldn't really... That concept doesn't really translate very well to digital games, though, I assume.
It doesn't, but maybe it should, and maybe that's something that'll happen in the long run. It's one of the reasons why it works okay for books is that there's books are a little bit longer in some cases. You don't want to have a game that is an hour long, and there are plenty of games that are an hour long. Don't even ask questions about that. There are plenty of them. And you say, okay, well, I'm going to buy my game that's an hour long, and I'm going to let my friend borrow it, and on the back end, my friend pays me a buck, and you know, we both get a cheaper game out of it. That is a bad deal for the publishers, it's a bad deal for the developers, and it would absolutely happen in a game environment, whereas I don't think that that's something that happens with books to the same extent. The library system has existed for years and years and centuries. It isn't so much of a deal with books for whatever reason.
I was about to bring up that libraries kind of set the precedent for that for games, and even now, or not games, for books, and even now for CDs and DVDs. You can go to the library, and granted, you're not getting the latest and greatest for about a year based on the wait list at my library whenever I try to get the newest movie, but you can still do it.
Well, don't a lot of, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't a non-zero number of authors kind of hate libraries because it's so kind of viewed as theft?
There are book publishers that will, well, that's why the book publishers will limit the libraries to their, on their digital books.
Mm-hmm,
like my county will only have like one copy of a digital book, which seems ridiculous. You don't have to print it. You should have infinite copies, but they specifically limit it for a certain window to force people that really, really want it to be like, screw it, I'm just going to go buy the book because I'm never going to get it from the library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that, I mean, that's probably to counteract that whole idea that, well, if everyone can just rent the book from the library, why would anyone buy it?
Yeah.
Well, the other part of that is if that's what the cost is, then you say, okay, library, to get the digital copy, you have to pay this amount and that many people read it. It's all about the pricing of it. And the pricing to the library system has historically been, yes, the library copies are more expensive. They're printed better, they're bound better, and they last longer as a result of those things. But that does not cover all of the extra costs. The library cost is also more because they know it's going to be passed around. So the library printings cost more for the library. The digital version is the exact same thing. They're already charging a premium for the digital copies. They don't want those extra copies going out. How much of this is, for lack of better words, a price gouging by the developer? And how much of it is a reasonable thing? Hey, we've got to get paid for the work that we put into this and the work that the author put into it.
Although
those are good questions.
Well, one point though to the library is, I believe public libraries are supported by taxes.
Yes.
So that's something that video games don't have access to. They don't have access to taxpayer money, at least not right now.
Two points on that.
Uh-oh, he's holding his finger up.
Are you is Kurt Schilling will like have a word with you? Is that what you're going to bring up, Andrew?
I wasn't going to bring up Kurt Schilling specifically, but that's a really good example, too.
Yeah.
My first point of this is that some libraries are renting video games as well.
Yeah, Baltimore County, I actually rented DuckTales for Xbox that way.
Yeah, so it happens, even for video games. Similar kind of idea. And if it isn't the libraries, there are game rental systems like Gamefly or Redbox. Now you have to pay a fee to them on a per-case basis. But that's still happening. So there is a rental industry for games, even outside of the blockbusters that are long since gone. The libraries do it based on the taxpayer thing, which is the only thing that separates them. As for taxpayers in general, they are absolutely paying for the production of video games. Maybe not so much in the United States, but even in the United States. If you go to the end credits of The Walking Dead, why is The Walking Dead in Savannah, in Georgia? Oh. Because Georgia paid them.
But you're talking about the TV show or the video game?
It starts with a TV show, okay, but it continues on, and the production value, you know, the funds for the tourism thing for Georgia continue to flow into The Walking Dead. There are many games produced overseas. Australia has a huge credit for video game developers developing video games in Australia. Wales has a video game credit for video games produced in Wales. Norway has a video game credit. Taxes, money being given to the developers out of the taxpayer treasury to support this industry so that they can have this software tech so it's not just all happening in Silicon Valley. They're trying to make sure that this kind of business exists in their territory as well.
So like Australians pay a tax that goes to Australian video game companies?
There's no specific tax.
Right.
You're going to pay this 3 extra cents on your bread, but the tax revenues are collected however they're collected.
Right.
And then the government says, okay, we're going to, as part of our arts grant, give $700,000 to this video game developer who makes a video game about our Australian national treasure story. So there's a book by an Australian author called Storm Boy, and it got turned into a video game also called Storm Boy. It's a pretty emotional book. meant for little kids, but it's still got an emotional story to it. And it's reasonably successful, hugely popular book in Australia, turned into this massively successful video game for certain crowds. I mean, it's not something that you're going to enjoy going out and playing, most likely. You probably wouldn't dislike it. But the reason why it's popular with people that I know is that you play it for an hour or two tops, and you've played through the entire story because it's a children's novel, not even a novel, like picture book almost. And it's been turned into this video game where you explore the world a little bit more and hear the story happening. It plays out. And that was funded by grants.
And it's not just video games. I mean, this kind of stuff happens for all sorts of businesses.
Well, yeah, that's why I asked. I knew in the end credits of movies and TV shows, you always see like special thanks to whatever cities they filmed in that pay. They almost bid probably to have stuff produced in their cities.
Absolutely. It's a big business. And so, yeah, that's one place where your tax money is going.
Yeah, I mean, you saw it probably its most naked and obvious during the Amazon HQ2 thing, where cities were actively like just throwing out incentives and money and everything. But it happens on a smaller level to a lot of other companies.
And the biggest example also is sports complexes. But yeah, mm-hmm. like that's the most egregious example of taxpayer money being used for that. But
I'll tie two more together here so we can still talk about video games a little bit more, because there's still this taxes thing. Why does Uwe Boll make so many terrible video game movies, or did he in the past and stop now? Is that the German government had a tax credit that he was blatantly abusing to get his movies made, and he didn't care if they made money or not, and he didn't care if they were good or not, because he was getting essentially paid by the German government to make these movies.
But why did the German government care about, I don't even remember which games he was adapting, like, didn't he do Blood Rain or something? And a couple, like In the Name of the King or something like
he was frankly abusing that system pretty badly. And that's one of the reasons why he's not doing it anymore.
Well, I mean, it's also because politicians want to be able to stand up in front of people and be like, look, I brought this. And again, in the case of Uwe Boll, it's probably not I brought this prestige, but you're hoping that like, look, I brought this sports team to your, to everybody. Well, right. I brought this. And it's, I'll reference back to economics in one lesson. It's the, everyone sees the thing, like, I brought this sports team, but they don't see, like, the taxes that they paid and that went out to this sports team to bring it there. So you're seeing all the benefits and you're not seeing the costs as much. And that's why a lot of these politicians will want to do these things.
Even, possibly even worse, maybe your taxes don't even go up because they just said, we're going to stop funding this other stuff that you don't notice. Mm-hmm. And now the money's going somewhere else. And, like, that's even more of a, yeah, economics in one lesson. You don't see the money that's no longer going to somewhere else now.
And frankly, that's probably a lot of it too. It's not necessarily they're just outright giving the money. It's tax breaks and tax incentives like that. So you're not collecting future taxes on these things. So yeah, that plays a role in it too.
So, unless Andrew has one more point about taxes, but he's not putting his finger up.
Nope.
You had another thing that you said about. So it's actually kind of neat to me that the Game Pass, originally you said it was like the Netflix of games, but Netflix doesn't let you buy something when it's going to go away. Sure,
That's true. You
can go to Amazon, you can go to Google, you can go to other places and buy it, but once it's gone from Netflix, Netflix no longer can kind of get your money for that. They're getting your money for a billion other reasons, but whatever. But it's been interesting because I signed up for Amazon Music. I finally bit the bullet and added that onto my Prime membership. Originally I just had Amazon Music Prime, and I pretty much only listened to that. And they kept throwing 3-month unlimited subscriptions at me. And eventually I looked at the price, and like, of course it's lower because I'm a Prime member. So I was like, fine, I'll just pay for the unlimited at an annual rate, and it's like $6 a month. And like, now I have almost zero. I'm almost the opposite. I have zero desire to buy any music from Amazon now, because I said, I'm already subscribed. I can listen to it. Like the Ozzy album apparently came out 3 months ago, and I only learned it came out now. Like, I just downloaded it from Amazon Music Unlimited. In the past, I would have actually, I would have immediately gone out and bought it.
Right. For something like Amazon Music, it has the risk of potentially crowding out music that isn't on the service. That was already something that was worried about or existed within the radio system. If it wasn't being played on the radio, how did you know it existed? There was still the indie music scene, but it was very much not the mainstream. Now the mainstream is going to be, it's on Amazon Music. For something like Game Pass, it's still a long way away, but that could happen, where if you're not on Game Pass, you're not part of the mainstream either. You're this independent avant-garde game, and maybe that's why you're not on Game Pass. But also, that could mean that the Game Pass environment, or a Netflix for games kind of environment, no matter where it is, could end up hurting developers in a way where they can't make games that are as niche. Despite the fact that many niche games do currently succeed on Game Pass, there's only room for so many of them. And that is one of the things about video game development right now, is that there are so many games being developed that it's sometimes hard to find the ones that are good. So Xbox is saying, hey, we're going to curate this. We're going to give you access to 150 of the ones that we think are the best. But maybe they think they're the best because those are the ones they already have the relationship with the developers by. Maybe they're not actually the best.
Well, that was interesting when you said, I cut Paul off a little bit maybe, but that's interesting that you said it might be harder for a niche game, but it's because they're limiting the number of games in Game Pass. If it was like Music Unlimited, where like basically anything that's available on Xbox was automatically in Game Pass, wouldn't niche games almost have a better, they wouldn't have a worse chance, I guess is my point, because more people would be able to take a chance on them if you just randomly were flicking through and be like, oh, I haven't heard of this game. Oh, well, I already basically paid for it by being a member. Let me just try it.
Yeah, that was my theory. And I think Andrew and I talked about this briefly before, and I have a hard time expressing why I think this way, but I have this theory that this kind of subscription model where you have access to a wide variety of games, and I'm not entirely sure how the payout works, but I'm assuming that Microsoft just says, hey, if you agree to have your game on Game Pass, we'll give you, I don't know, $1,000 a month or whatever it is. I have this theory that that will help those niche games, because you may have a game that maybe has a really strong appeal to 1% of the population, and that's probably that 1% of the population, no matter how strongly they love your game, they're probably not going to buy enough copies to make that game successful. But that 1% of the population may be so excited about your game that they're willing to pay that to subscribe to Game Pass and make it worthwhile for Microsoft to pay to include you in Game Pass, and it could just make the economics work a little bit better, because you can, in a way, you can almost measure the passion of your fan base a little bit more. Instead of having like a Call of Duty, or I shouldn't throw Call of Duty under the bus, but let's just say
Call of Duty under the bus. Okay. They totally deserve it.
Okay, well, let's just say a phone of what's a synonym for duty, honor or something, some generic game that lots of people like, but nobody's like really super in love with. Those games are going to succeed anyway. But it's the games that have a really small but very dedicated fan base, that those are the ones that need to be nurtured. And I think that they can be nurtured using this this kind of.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about it in terms of like, maybe it's not apples to apples here, but like, I will, and also there's other ways to sample music, so it's maybe a bad example, but like Amazon Music Unlimited now, if I'm reading like an article anywhere, like, and it mentions like some song from an artist or a band, I can be like, I can immediately go over, listen to the song or the album or whatever, and be like, okay, yeah, I don't like that. But now I know, instead of like not being able to know. I mean, music maybe is different because, yeah, I could probably just hop onto YouTube and probably listen to the song if I really wanted to, or you could always listen to 30-second clips of songs. So it's not, I understand it's not quite the same.
No, I think it's comparable, because like I mentioned earlier, I played a game called Indivisible that I almost certainly would not have, I wouldn't have paid money to play, yeah, to buy it or anything like that. It's allowed me, and there's been a ton of other games that I've tried out and ended up playing and beating. I think Shantae and the Half-Genie Hero, all these other, yeah, things that normally I'd look at and be like, you know, I wouldn't mind trying it, but I'm not going to spend even $5 or $10 on it. And so, I ended up liking them.
So does it work better or worse, though, do you think? Because they at least used to almost always have demos available on Xbox games. So you could play like the first level or whatever like that. Does that still exist?
There are many games that have demos. They're not universal, maybe. And even if they don't have demos, you know, the same thing with, oh, can go listen to 30 seconds of the song on YouTube. You can go and watch the trailer on YouTube. You can watch somebody reviewing the game on YouTube. You can go watch somebody doing a long play of the game on YouTube. In almost every single situation, unless the game is absolutely new, it's something where you can go and find that out with some effort. The difference is that listening to music or reading a book even is a little more passive. Playing a game, you're an active participant in that experience. You're making choices. Mm-hmm. If it's a narrative thing, you're maybe making choices that affect the story. You're at least making choices about how to play the game, at what speed to play the game. And by making those choices, it impacts your actual experience of that game. And different people play it different ways and get a different experience out of it as a result. That's one of the reasons why games are so different from any other medium, is because the player is the agent in the game rather than the storyteller, the narrator. You are the person who's in charge of that. And that means that when you play it, it's a very, very different experience than sitting down and watching someone else play it. Streaming video games with Twitch or Mixer is extremely popular. People love to watch someone else play the game. And I think one of the reasons that people love watching other people play the games is because they can watch that person play the game and say, okay, yeah, that was really cool. This guy's really good at the game, but if I were playing it, this is how I would have done it differently. And they're imagining that in their head already, because it's not just watching the story unfold, but actually placing yourself into it in that regard.
So how many, I've always wondered that about Twitch, how many people are watching streams of games that they themselves do not play? Because your comparison about, you know, you could watch like YouTube videos of long plays of games and everything. It's one thing to like listen to a 30-second clip or of a music or read the first chapter of a book, because like that's the same experience you're going to get just in a shorter form. A game, you watch somebody play Street Fighter, you're not going to pick up the game and be playing that the same way.
I think that's an excellent point, and I don't know that I can answer how many people watch Twitch that don't play the game, but I know a lot of people watch Twitch overall. It's a hugely popular service, and people watch for a lot of reasons. They watch because they're curious about what the game looks like. They want to see the game played at the highest level. They're curious about what they're going to play next, or they don't have the money to play the game, but they want to get the experience of playing, and they love the interactivity of it. You know, one of the reasons why I think Twitch succeeds is getting right back to this idea of games as interactive. Twitch is interactive. You may not be the one playing the game, but at least you're interacting with the person who is playing the game. It's like sitting on the couch next to your friend who's playing while you're also still having a conversation that we used to do way back when.
I must say, that's a whole other conversation about going over to your buddy's house and being able to even just pick up a second controller and play, which is largely gone from a lot of games now.
Couch co-op is not something that exists nearly as much as it should, but you know, I think we are kind of at a pivot point for gaming in general. I think that there's Netflix as a model thing could work for it. I think Game Pass has done it really, really well. And I think there's a lot of mileage to go there, but maybe we got something else.
Yeah, so one more thing on that, actually. I think from an investing standpoint, the whole gaming as a subscription, I guess GAS or whatever you want to call it, the Netflix model.
Everything is eventually turning into a service.
As a service,
right?
Yeah. Sorry,
you don't own anything. Yeah.
I don't want to call it the Holy Grail, but I do think that's something that a lot of the companies involved would like to work towards, because gaming, especially for a purely gaming company, is very lumpy. You know, you spend a lot of money over many months and years to produce a game that you hope will be a hit, and even if it is a hit, it's a lot of money that one month or that one quarter. And then unless you find a way to really monetize it after the fact, which the companies are trying to do with, you know, like loot boxes and add-ons and stuff like that, and expansions and new maps and whatever, it's still pretty lumpy. Whereas if you can make this as the subscription model is a very appealing model, because it makes things nice and consistent, and you can expect like, oh, we have 1 million paying users now. We're probably going to have roughly 1 million paying users next month too. And so you can kind of have that revenue that you can count on. So I think this is probably going to be the future, if it's not obvious. And maybe that hurts Andrew's ownership heart, but I think that's probably where things are going to be going.
It also might lead to the death of Black Friday finally, because I remember the minimalists always talk about whatever I don't know what their mobile company was, but they used to work for one of the big mobile companies or something. And it was like the entire sales was predicated on Black Friday, basically.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I think most retail is like that. Like something like 80% of your business is done on Black Friday or something ridiculous like that.
Well,
the reason why it's called Black Friday is because that's the day of the year when you go from red to black.
Right.
Yeah. That's at least the old wives' tale. I don't know. Is that actually true, do you know? Or is that just what they
say? I have no idea if it's actually true. I think that any company that is so behind that they need a day in late third quarter, fourth quarter to go and become profitable is probably doing something wrong.
Well, I was going to say, the fact that it's so late in the year, hopefully you're already in the black.
But you know, it's not just the day, though. It's the holiday season. And
the holiday season is definitely a huge, huge deal. No one's denying that.
Which is, although I always think of that as a modern concept, holiday creep and everything. You go back and watch Charlie Brown Easter. And even in that, the 70s or maybe early 80s, even in that, they walk into the store and the signs are up, only 272 days until Christmas. So
it was a joke back then.
It's been around for a while, yeah.
Yeah. All right, one thing I want to talk about is there was a tweet from Glenn Kelman, who is the CEO of Redfin. And I'm not going to do it justice, but he basically was touching upon how...
Wait, can't you just read the tweet?
I could if I was prepared. Okay, thank you for shining a light on how ill-prepared I am.
What's his name? Glenn
Kelman.
Kelman?
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's going to be 280 characters at most. It's just faster to read it.
Well, okay, I have his Twitter.
The thing is, it was like the seventh tweet in a tweet storm, and so it requires a lot of build-up. So Andrew can go ahead and find it. But the
here it is, 7 of 7.
Sure. What does it say?
7 of 9.
Resistance is futile.
As of this is May 14th, he posts this. All of this is put together every week by my brilliant colleague Adam Redfin, with his input from Redfin's amazing agents, so there are many more juicy insights.
That is not the right one.
That is a very boring tweet.
All right, if you want,
except for the fact that somebody actually has the name Adam Redfin.
No, it's someone. Adam, and his Twitter handle is Adam Redfin. So
okay, I was gonna say.
Yeah, apparently there's been a tweet storm since then. I'm scrolling through it now. This is riveting podcasting. Okay. Let's see.
I think we all are better for knowing Adam Redfin now.
There's another his tweet 5 of 5 for another one is hats off to Adam Redfin again.
So, he loves this Adam Redfin guy.
Yeah. You could have just let me give the gist of it, but no.
You could just give the gist of it now.
Give the gist now.
Okay. Yeah, so the idea was basically, and for those who don't know, Redfin is in the business of it's a real estate company allowing people to buy and sell homes.
I sold my house using Redfin.
Oh, there you go. Good job. Thank you. You're helping the Freedom Portfolio grow. The idea was that the coronavirus, I want to preface this by saying that I'm not somebody who hugely obsesses over inequality. I know that's a big theme recently about like the haves and the have-nots and how the rich keep getting richer, the poor keep getting poorer. I'm not saying that's not the case, but it's not something that overly concerns me and that I obsess over like some other people do. But this tweet did hit home. And the idea was that the coronavirus and all this lockdown and social distancing and whatnot that's been happening over the past couple months, it almost seems like there are two different, it's hitting people in very differently. The people who have the ability to work from home, that have the money to weather the storm, they have the emergency funds, the savings, they're seeing this as, if anything, it's a boon. It's actually great. Like, they're able to work from home. They gas is cheap. Borrowing money is cheap. They're able to refinance their homes. They're able to upgrade into larger houses and get cheap mortgages. And there's all this talk about how the government stimulus has gone, maybe not necessarily to the people who need it the most, the individuals who need the money, but to businesses and other people like that. And then on the other side, there's people who they can't work from home. They own a restaurant, or they have to go, they're a work in a retail store or something like that, and they've basically been able to do nothing and are stuck at home, and they don't have the ability to take advantage of all these low mortgage rates and whatnot. And it really struck home to me, and I'm curious, I guess, what you guys, your thoughts, because one of the criticisms, you see a lot of these protests going around the country about, like, oh, you know, reopen the state, and people are mocking them, and I understand the mockery, and some of it is deserved, but you also see some of these, like, millionaire comedians who are like, oh, you know, your grandparents were asked to go over to Europe and die to fight the Nazis, and you're just being asked to sit on your ass and watch Netflix all day. And that, to me, strikes me as incredibly unfair. And once again, I'm not a guy that's super obsessed with privilege and whatnot, but it strikes me as coming from a position of privilege there, of being able to say, like, you know, just stay at home and watch Netflix. It sounds like, you know, let them eat cake kind of thing, where a lot of people, they can't just stay at home and eat Netflix. No, they can't just stay at home and sit on their butt and binge the newest shows. Their livelihoods have been ruined. Like, businesses that they've built up and had for years are going bankrupt. And it seems tone deaf to do that. And I'm curious what you guys have thought.
Well, I think I've mentioned, because we've touched upon coronavirus every episode since it started.
Yeah, I had to bring it up again.
Well, no, but like I think last time
it's going to come up a lot.
I think the last time we were talking was maybe when the stimulus checks, maybe the first, if the bill passes the Senate, if the first stimulus check went out. And I think I said like something to the along lines of like, I almost feel guilty about getting the money, because kind of to your point, besides the kids being home, not really much, and like obviously we're not going out or anything, but like our day-to-day, like weekday life isn't really all that different. I was still going to work. I wasn't working from home. If I had a program that I could, I would have been able to work from home though. So yeah, so I get, and like my wife would keep asking about if we needed to have the school give us a second Chromebook so that both kids could have one for their schooling. I was like, no. We can buy another laptop. Let the county give that laptop to somebody who literally can't afford it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. I mean, I feel really bad saying this, but I was just thinking recently, maybe yesterday, a couple days ago, this has been, I'm almost at the most well-off part of my life that I can think of my entire life. I was not just when I can think of, like, our solar panels that we had bought before all this happens. Like, it's a long involved process. We would never have decided to get solar panels during this whole thing, but they've come online. So I'm anticipating virtually zero energy bills going forward, which is great. That frees up a lot of money. We're currently in talks about refinancing our house, which will bring down our interest rate probably a full percentage point or more, which will free up another couple hundred dollars a month going forward. And I'm running all these projections on, you know, how long until we can retire and everything. And a lot of my metrics are moving pretty drastically in a good way right now in terms of the amount of money we can save every month. My portfolio is, and this is, I kind of come across as a humble brag, my portfolio is hit an all-time high, which is
amazing. I read your Paul versus the Market update.
Like, it's up something ridiculous, like 40% for the year, which is just incredible, or maybe the quarter. Either way, it's an incredible amount, and it's so strange and such an odd feeling to feel so. Wealthy is the wrong word, because I still don't feel wealthy, but like, you know, my finances are in a pretty good place, and the entire country is in a pretty bad place.
I think we've also mentioned, all three have mentioned that before, is like, we don't feel wealthy, mm-hmm. but the fact is, yeah. by the numbers, we probably are actually all wealth, especially if you consider the world. But even
globally,
if you just consider,
absolutely, yeah.
Because like, yeah, I look at like these stimulus checks. I look at it and be like, granted, you know, we're a single income family already, and we planned our budget to do that. But I'm like, really? Like, a dual income family, like, that's the threshold for when they're going to cut it all? Like, cause it's like, you'd basically both have to be making $100,000 in order for them to cut you off from all the stimulus. It's like, that's a lot of money compared to the median income.
Well, the point of that was they wanted to get the money out to the majority of the people. The means testing is very minimal means testing at that point. And that helps because it makes it easier to administrate, for one thing. It also makes it feel fairer to everyone else because, yes, you and I and Paul, we're not hurting too bad in this. But there are plenty of people who are a lot like us financially who are. You know, a small business owner could have a profile of income that looks a lot like ours, and yet they are devastated right now, whereas we're not, because we happen to work for employers that are not as badly impacted.
I was about to say, like, I mean, there are people with our type of jobs that could work, but the company can't afford to keep you at this point, and they're letting you go. Because I think I saw, like, Kickstarter just let go a bunch of people, and it's like, you're a totally digital platform. Can't you all just work teleworkers? It seems like it shouldn't affect it, but there's probably a trickle-down effect of... Now, not as many people are kick. I have no idea how Kickstarter's financial system works, how they get any money. But like, I imagine there's not as many people kickstarting stuff if people literally don't have jobs to get money to go buy stuff.
And there's going to be a suppression of entrepreneurship in general right now. This is not the time when people are going to be looking to take on more risk in their own lives. So they're going to say, okay, that project that I have that sounds like a really cool idea that I want to do that I might have put on Kickstarter, maybe I don't even do it right now. So I imagine that even their number of projects on Kickstarter is dropping significantly.
And production might be backed up because, like, I don't know, I'm just taking board games as an example. Like, buddy, like, if the factories that build all the components that you need to produce your game are not open right now, you can't even promise that you'll be able to get it out at a timely rate.
Yeah. So a point to Paul's point about feeling like this is maybe, you know, his best moment right now, this is a lagging thing, I would say. You're feeling okay because your portfolio is looking okay. Great. And I hope that it continues to be the case. I hope that it will continue to be up or growing or at least steady for the next 6 months, 18 months, 6 years, whatever your horizon is. I hope that that continues to be the case so you don't lose that confidence. But if things are bad, the market will go down. It rebounded substantially because it expects things to recover pretty well. But what if it doesn't? What if because the people who are at the bottom get squeezed the hardest and they don't have any money that we can't recover, then that could dramatically impact things in the long run. And it's just that you are going to feel that pain later because you're not at that pinch point. You're not going to feel it until later. You're further up the chain. And, you know, I'm very grateful that I am as well, but I have real concerns that this is just starting. So I do feel exactly what you're saying. People were saying, okay, this is really bad, but this is something we need to do and it's going to hurt. And you people out there complaining about this need to just deal with it. There are literally people out there who cannot just deal with it, and they cannot just deal with it because their employers aren't giving them the things that they need to just deal with it, the government isn't giving them things they need to just deal with it, and they don't have the things they need to just deal with it themselves because they were never in that position to start with. And if they are hurting, that will hurt the entire economy, that'll hurt us in the long run, one way or another. If it's not an economic thing where it's just this 25% chunk cut off of the GDP, then it's going to be a revolution where they say, okay, it's either this or starving, and they get violent.
You sound like Bane from The Dark Knight Rises. Like,
I've still not seen this movie. Like,
your reckoning will come.
I've still not seen that movie, believe it or not.
You have not seen The Dark Knight Rises?
No, for whatever reason, I think it was a kid was being born right around that time, and then I had a conference.
Presumably one of yours.
Well, definitely one of mine. I had a kid.
Wait, have you seen Batman Begins?
Yes, I love Batman Begins.
Have you seen
We've
The Dark
had this
Knight?
Conversation. I have seen Dark Knight. It's very, very good.
And you decided, I'm going to take a pass on Dark Knight.
No,
Rises.
I wanted to see it, but I never got a chance to go see it in the theaters because, you know, things in my life were really busy. And since I didn't see it in the theaters, and I, generally speaking, don't like watching movies by myself, I've just never watched it. I've never watched the third one.
I think Dark Knight Rises was... If it wasn't it was certainly one of the last movies my wife saw in the theater. Partially because Bruce, our son, was born shortly after that came out. Because she was pregnant when we saw it. And then every time Bane was on the screen talking, she says that he was kicking. It's like, well, that's... We didn't know his name was Bruce at that point because we hadn't named him. We didn't even know the gender yet. But in retrospect, that makes total sense that Bruce would be kicking every time he heard Bane talking.
And for the record, we had not named our daughter yet. And I don't think she would. She saw, for the record, yeah, Talia al Ghul. For the record.
You just waited until you heard our name was Bruce and you said, oh, sweet, we'll name our kid Talia.
Yeah, it was already on our list. It was on our spreadsheet. I can show it
You're
to
you. Just preordaining that they'll create the next Robin.
Damien,
yeah. Except for that means you have to start calling Bruce Detective.
Listen, there are worse comic book characters to be compared to than Ra's al Ghul.
Ra's al Ghul is just amazing. So yeah,
you are growing out your goatee a little bit like him. Yeah. I noticed.
Just need that streaky gray now.
I decided there's during this. I figured if I'm not going to be allowed out of the house to see anybody and not going to be really held responsible for my grooming, there are two options. I can either completely shave my head, which I've always kind of wondered what I'd look like with. As a big fan of Star Trek, you know, Jean-Luc Picard, I'm like, I wonder how I'd look with a shaved head. Or I can go the other route and just let it all grow out because.
And this is what it looks like when it's all grown out. It's a whole, it's like 2 inches long.
Yeah. Unfortunately, apparently it takes like 3 years for my hair to go anywhere. But like right now I just look unkempt and I don't quite have the Fabio like flowing locks as I was hoping for. Maybe not Fabio, but.
Well, I only went down to 3/8 of an inch. I know that because that's what my. That's what the
yeah we have the same
stopper
thing.
The stopper whatever on my razor says, and I was like, screw it, no one's at work. This is the time to see what I look like. I haven't had hair this short probably since middle school, I think.
Yeah, my hair's always been somewhere between like, yeah, well, you know, like somewhat short and regular length. So
yes, I used to have to keep my hair long to counteract your short hair.
Yeah,
right. Keep the balance, keep the yin and yang of the universe.
Yeah, the balance of our dorm room.
Regular length. Okay.
For a male. I understand what you're thinking. Your hair is not regular length.
That stopped conversation right there.
Well, that's not good podcasting. Give me a look like that.
let's see if I can roll this one back in, because I'm actually a little bit confused by your question. You started this off with this Redfin discussion.
Yeah.
The tweet
and now we're on Dark Knight.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely taken a turn for that. I would like to thank Devil's Backbone. You know.
Oh, yeah, we were supposed to talk about the...
And Glenn Coco from Black Flag. This is the beer I told you guys like I had last week. And it's only 6%. It felt way more than 6% last week.
Yeah. Well, I like to thank C3PO, which is the glass that I'm drinking my Devil's Backbone out of. Apparently, Andrew and I had the same idea of the Vienna Lager. Is that what it's called?
Yep. And we're drinking the Devil's Backbone Vienna Lager tonight, which is...
I'm on my third.
One of my favorite local brews. Very, very good. Highly recommend it. So that is inspiring us to take this conversation in weird paths, let's say. But you start this with Redfin. Because some people are able to be in a position where they're buying a house and getting really good deals out of it, right? That's the point.
Yeah, so I think Glenn Kelman has always kind of, he's always kind of been sensitive to the idea that there are people out there who are less well off, and so I think that's where he was approaching, is that for people who have the money and the means and the time and everything else, the privileged, for lack of a better term, this is a good time to do whatever, to refinance or to buy another house, you know, upgrade your house or buy a house for the first time if you're a renter, or heck, even buy like a vacation house or an investment property, or maybe you feel like you don't want to be in New York City anymore for obvious reasons, to buy a house in upstate New York and telecommute. There's a lot of doors opening and a lot of cheaper possibilities for people who have means right now, while the other half of the country or 60, 70, 80%, I don't know how big, is suffering right now. And it's kind of a weird dichotomy.
Yeah, one short anecdote was, this was even like a month ago, I think. There was a guy outside of the grocery store, which is a mostly rare sight in Howard County. Like in the top 2% of affluent counties in the country or something, I think.
When you say he's panhandling or something?
Yeah, so okay. He was panhandling. And I was kind of passing him, but he was asking another guy, and I think I misheard, but I'm pretty sure the other guy gave the usual snide remark of, you know, like, just get a job. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, in retrospect, I'm thinking like, that was possibly the meanest thing you could say at this point in time of like, oh, just go get a job. It's like, do you not know what's going on?
Yeah.
Well, to a certain extent, it may be less mean than it usually is. There are probably some locations that are starving for employment, for people who are willing to take the risk of going out and potentially getting sick because they have to be in contact with people. And because their normal employees either got sick already and are on, you know, home leave and have to take care of themselves, or are so concerned about being sick that they're saying, you know, it's not worth what you're paying me, so I'm not going to take that chance. So the person who is in that straits can say, well, I guess I can get the job, maybe. But yeah, I mean, employment is way, way down right now. And so we're going to see negative effects from that. It could be increased panhandling. It could be increased employment roles. It could be all those things that come along with that. There are a lot of people who are hurting really bad right now because of this. But a lot of it is harder for us to see. And it's very easy for us, and Paul's talking about this punching down of privilege of, I can stay home and handle this because I have some reserves or my job continues to pay me and I can stay home and do my job from home. That doesn't work in every single situation. A lot of those people who are out protesting are people like small business owners. A guy who runs a restaurant is very much more likely to be part of the protest because his restaurant can't open or has to open at 50% capacity, and that's not enough for him to pay his staff and pay himself and pay the rent. So somebody's going to take a pay cut. Or he doesn't open at all. It's like, it's not worth it. So help me protest and get out there so we can open up or without these restrictions and take the risk for people who are willing to. But the next part of that question is, are the people willing to? How many people actually are going to go out and say, okay, I'll take the risk and be in that restaurant? There's going to be a lot of businesses that will be so badly hurt by this because even if this is not something that's government mandated, each individual person making the decision that's best for themselves will result in situations where a lot of those companies will cease to have sufficient business to survive. And that means that business will go under. And when that happens, then that business owner and all his employees are out of work and replaced by what exactly? I mean, are we all going to be teleworking? Is every single industry going to go to telework? Are we all going to be doing Grubhub all the time? What's going to be left of the service industry when so much of our stuff, because we don't really make anything in the United States anymore. We have services and we have abstract concepts as a job. So if we're not doing services anymore, we are going to see massive problems with our economy.
We're all going to work for Facebook.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of talk going on. I mean, well, you guys laughed at me when I said we should nationalize Facebook, and rightfully so.
I don't
think
Paul laughed. He was actually speechless. Yes. But yeah.
I think I pounded my head on the table is what I did.
Your head, not your fist. So progress.
Take my shoe off and bang the table.
But if something like universal basic income becomes the response to this, where we say, okay, we are in such bad straits that, you know, we don't see the way forward in our economy, we're going to just give out enough money and tax Facebook to such an extent that they can pay for this because they're the only business left that can support anything, then that looks an awful lot like what I was talking about a year ago, 2 years ago.
I'm not so sure it does. Here's a question. Why bother taxing Facebook when you can just keep printing money?
That's a really great question, honestly.
Money printer go burr, as the hodlers might say.
Well, I can't remember if I asked that last time too. I was like, besides deficit spending, where's all this stimulus money coming from?
Two places.
Like, deficit spending. If there's literally less business going on, so there's less taxes coming in, that's not really federal anyway.
You need to read what has government done to our money. You need to read it now.
It's too late. It's too late.
I'm sorry. It's too late. You need to have read it like a couple months ago.
I'm actually reading books almost diametrically opposed to that too. I'm reading about Bruce Lee and Zen. So I think those are almost, those might be the exact opposite end of the spectrum.
So Paul and I have had a couple of jabs back and forth, especially when we've done our politics things. He's been calling me a Keynesian. And I'll be perfectly clear. I am not a Keynesian. I do not believe in what Keynes believes about monetary theory at all. I am intrigued by ideas that are related to Keynesianism, but I don't think that they're accurate. I just think that we will be playing around with them a whole lot more, and so we have to understand how this is going to come out. If we are spending more than we're taking in, that's a deficit. But if we're spending more than we're taking in, yes, that's a deficit for the government, but it is a surplus for everyone else, right?
Yes. That's the idea.
Right. That's the whole point. That's what you're trying to do. You say, okay, government take on this deficit because the government can borrow and print money. And that's really what's happening. Yes, this is deficit spending. Yes, they're borrowing money from the future, but only when Congress is authorizing it. When the Federal Reserve is saying, holy shit, look at what's going on in that economy, we're going to have to press that button and print a whole lot of reserve bonds, then they're essentially creating money. They're printing money in a very digital fashion and giving it to the banks and saying, take this and loan it to somebody, please, to stimulate the economy. And we're doing that for this very explicit purpose of the economy itself, without this intervention, is deflating at depressionary levels.
So I'm curious about how many people are spending the stimulus money in a way that would actually stimulate the economy? Because if you go by like some of the people that are the worst off, they just have to use it to like pay the rent.
Yep.
And then other people, like maybe people like well off like us, are being like, well, cool, this just can go into my, you know, into my IRA or my savings account, and like I don't even need to spend it. So like,
well,
I'm always curious how many people are actually spending it for its purpose.
You say some of them have to use it just to pay the rent. I would push back on that a little bit, because there is the mortgage and rent forbearance programs, right? Where you can decide not to pay for a couple months, which interestingly enough, going back to the whole like unintended consequences, that sounds like a great program, right? Like, oh, just tell everyone they don't have to pay their mortgage or rent for a couple months.
But you're going to owe all the interest when it comes due, don't you?
Sure, but you don't realize that like there are people who are counting on those rent payments. And furthermore, there are also entities that are counting on those mortgage payments. And so all of a sudden, when those mortgage payments aren't coming in, the banks who are buying all those mortgage bonds and whatnot, the reason why the mortgage rates haven't been going down is because people are terrified to take on mortgages right now because they don't know if people are going to be paying them. So there's a lot of interconnected stuff.
Does the rental apply to like all rentals? Like if, like, we have friends who own houses and rent them out, right? Are their rents allowed to be not paid under this, program? Or
I honestly don't know.
Whatever it is. Because it seems like that, you know, that obviously probably hurts. That hurts an actual person more so than, like, a person who owns, you know, 150 apartment complex.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories out there and about people who, they're being hurt by this. And, I mean, not quite the same thing, but there are lots, the Airbnb, there are people out there who have bought places with the sole intention of just renting out for Airbnb and counting on that Airbnb income. And
people that own houses down in the Outer Banks are probably not very happy right now.
Yeah. And so the idea is that there's going to probably be a flood of properties entering the market in like vacation areas like Miami and wherever else, of Airbnb owners who are getting screwed right now. Not screwed, I guess is maybe the wrong term, but like they took out a lot of debt to try and to buy these properties, and they can't pay the mortgages right now. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff that's been going down.
So this is probably a hard pivot, but to poking onto the concept of privilege, I just read an article today talking about how people at the, you know, at the actual stores have become like the front line. They compare them to sheriffs, basically, I think. But like they're the ones responsible for enforcing like masks and social distancing and all that in stores, and how some people get violent with them about they don't want to wear masks and everything. But then there's some tweet from somebody that they shared that, and I somewhat made the mistake of looking at what people were commenting on the thread. But I was actually surprised. No, this was actually a pleasant surprise that at least for me, because I agreed with what everybody was saying, was like, there's some example about some, I think of some video about a guy in Costco that I guess refused to wear his mask. And
yeah,
Paul's nodding his head like he saw this.
That was on
but
Twitter.
Like also, but like the sentiments in that and then in the article I read was these people that are going in and like demanding like, oh, my freedoms are being trampled because I have to wear a mask, are forgetting like you're on private property.
Yeah.
Like Costco is allowed to say you are not allowed to come in, and they don't really have to have a reason, right? I guess that's where the fine line comes in of like, where does discrimination turn on versus they're just not like, you're allowed to make your own rules. Like, I don't have to let anybody into my house that I don't want to.
I mean, they can't say you can't come in because you're gay, right? Or because you're black. But yeah,
this is actually,
outside of that, they are.
This is a really interesting reversal of a thing that was going on in the culture already, where people, for religious reasons, were wearing face coverings, and where a lot of people wanted to say, we don't want to let these people in because they're wearing face coverings, because, you know, maybe because of racist reasons, or because we can't see their faces, we don't know who they are, what they're up to, etc. And now the culture is shifting around where everyone is going to be wearing the face coverings, and we don't want to let this person in because they're not wearing a face covering, and now that's going to be okay.
Yeah, I hook that into the concept of privilege, because to me, the people that are not wanting to wear the face masks are coming from a station of privilege, because they say like, well, I'm not sick, but they don't care if other people are getting sick, is kind of, I don't know, that seems to me like that's kind of their stance of like, well, it's, you know,
you're not,
I'm not sick, I'm not going to get sick, therefore I'm not going to wear a mask.
You're not visibly sick. We don't, there's no evidence that you're sick.
Well, that's another point against them. Yeah, like, and that's kind of the point of the masks, right?
Yeah.
Was you might be sick and not know it, therefore just put the damn mask on, kind of thing. But then there's all the debates about whether they help or hurt, and you could go on with that all night too.
Yeah, to Andrew's point, I think there was a joke I saw about, I think it was France, because if I recall correctly, France
was having a huge problem
law prohibiting a certain hijab or some such. There's some sort of thing that they had prohibited, which was a little bit controversial at the time, and I don't even know if they still have it. But the joke was something along the lines of, you are forbidden from wearing a head covering, but you are required to wear a mask or something like that. And it's a weird kind of juxtaposition.
There's a foul language comic about it too, where there was protesters outside some store holding signs, you know, like refuse to wear a mask or something like that. And the other person in the comics group was saying, gee, I hate to see how they're going to react when they hear about the store's pants policy.
No shirt, no shoes, no service.
Yeah.
I want to invite you to the pants party.
The party in my pants.
I'm saying there's a party in your pants and I'm invited. Yes, the pants party.
Right. So another interesting... I get Anchorman. I get Anchorman.
That's 40-year-old virgin, isn't it? No, it is. Okay.
Yeah,
no,
Anchorman.
It is Anchorman. Yeah, yeah.
For shame.
It's still Steve Carell.
Yeah.
It's totally something the 40-year-old virgin would have said too.
Maybe.
Do you do it yourself?
What?
Have you not seen the 40-year-old virgin?
No.
You haven't?
Oh, okay.
You have not seen like every good movie ever.
That's your quarantine task.
I know.
I refuse to watch it.
Dark Knight Rises, 40-year-old virgin.
Dark Knight Rises,
fine. Replacements.
I've already seen the Replacements. Replacements are fine. I like that movie. This is not the movies podcast.
It's the grab bag podcast. We're allowed to talk about anything.
Yes. Anything and everything.
Paul's on his third beer.
Devil's backbone. That is one stiff backbone.
Talk about a privilege. You're drinking half a six pack.
Way to do math there. Mister, I can easily divide six by two. Right, do we have anything else to talk about my tweet that I never was able to find?
I think it's way more complicated than three guys who've been drinking beers should be talking about.
Well, I'm just surprised that you went so long about how you're not a Keynesian and never once decided you tried to describe what a Keynesian is.
Okay, so a Keynesian is someone who follows the school of thought of economics of Edmund Keynes? What's his first name?
John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah, not even close.
Edmund? That was way off.
I was going to ask if this was the Maynard guy, because for the longest time, I think, I thought he was the singer of Tool.
What?
Yes, because I understand why.
I don't really want to know.
The singer of Tool is what, Maynard James Keenan?
Yeah, Maynard James Keenan, and this is John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, it's yeah. I understand the and I do get that, and it's hilarious to me. Right. Because here's the thing, Keenan probably loves Keynes. You know, their politics are probably very closely aligned. But he probably also would hate Keynes for a very personal reason that I will not get into because it has nothing to do with this right now. But Keynes was an economic theorist right around the time of the Great Depression and World War II. And he was really influential on the policies of FDR. It's why we got the New Deal kind of policies going on, where government spending took off and was a massive inflator on the economy. And his major thought on this was, we spend government money when private money is not being spent. If the private money has resulted in a depression, then the government spends money to compensate for that. And then when things recover and the private money is doing well, we tax a lot so we can recover the funds and not be running deficits all the time.
The idea being that you wanted to fight deflation at all costs. And inflation because
deflation is more damaging than inflation. Mm-hmm. And I think that is actually true. I think deflation is more damaging than inflation in a lot of senses. The types of damage that it causes is much more structural. It gets to a deeper level. But I'm not a Keynesian because I don't believe that we should be taxing when things are good and spending when things are bad. I think we should not be spending at all in most cases. I am a huge proponent of, generally speaking, limiting the size of the federal government because I think it typically does things poorly and is better served if you want to do anything that the government you think that the government should be doing, then it's better served to do something like that in a different format where the government is the one in charge of it. And then when things are deflationary, then sure, maybe it's a good idea to spend, but then it's not so much of an issue because you haven't spent along the way. One of the reasons why the federal stimulus spending behind something like the Republican tax cut is such a bad idea is not just because it's it's inflationary and deficit spending, but because it doesn't provide any real benefit. You know, the money is not doing anything. Spending money now, giving people money through universal basic income or these stimulus checks, that is potentially beneficial both to the economy and to individuals. But even then, there's this real reticence to do it because it's not something that people are comfortable with. They want to means test everything. You know, means test even this stimulus check so that only people making less than $75,000 get the full amount, which is almost everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Almost everybody is getting the full amount here. So why bother? Because we don't want to say we're giving Bill Gates the money, basically, is what it comes down to. Because we want to be punitive to certain people because of the situation that they're already in. And that's really very, very weird. On to the spending writ large, whether or not spending into a deficit kind of scenario matters and is inflationary. It's only inflationary if the economy is in an inflationary spiral already. We are not. The current environment financial situation is so deflationary that the government could spend $5 trillion and not make a dent because the GDP is tanking, because people are not buying stuff. They're not going out. To Travis's point, how much effect does the stimulus actually have in terms of stimulating the economy? Not nearly as much as it would look like. So what do? Do you throw more on, or do you just suffer through the downturn and say, okay, this is really bad, it's going to suck, and we'll help people out who need help and get through it? And ultimately, I think those are your two choices. You can either spend $5 trillion, try and prevent the deflation from impacting people as badly as you can, or say it's going to be that bad and help people out on an individual basis.
Well, and this is also a unique deflationary situation, right? Where, like, even if you gave people thousands and thousands of dollars, based on where you live, like, you might have nowhere to spend it besides, like, Amazon and Walmart, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. you know, I can try and spend it with my local businesses, and I'm trying to. You know, I take my stimulus check, and I spend a little bit at my local game store, and I spend a little bit of it at my local restaurant that's still open and doing some takeout, and I spend some of it in my local businesses that happen to be chains, but at least I'm spending it there rather than through Amazon. And I spent some of it through Amazon, too. I can't not buy some stuff from Amazon, it seems. And then I save a lot of it. And I save a lot of it specifically because I have grave concerns that this is not even close to over. So I need to have my cash reserves for the next leg when this goes further downhill, because it's rolling downhill and it's still gathering speed.
Why do you think we haven't seen much inflation since 2007, 2008, when everyone was predicting that quantitative easing and the actions of the Federal Reserve would create at least inflation, if not hyperinflation?
Fantastic point, because absolutely, you know, one of the things I saw in 2007, 2008 was this massive economic repercussion of the housing crisis, and that was a big, big deal. And I was right. I saw that coming. I didn't see it exactly perfectly right. I'm not a genius in that regard, but I knew things were bad, and I knew they were about to get really, really bad. And I said, okay, here's what I think, spitball, the government's going to have to do. $2 trillion was my number. And I said, there's no way that the federal government spends $2 trillion. And I was absolutely right. They didn't. They spent $800 billion, which is about a third of what they needed to cover the hole. And so instead, what happened was the Federal Reserve stepped up and did the rest. All that extensive stuff was all from the Federal Reserve. They covered the rest of the $1.6 trillion, $2 trillion, $2.5 trillion that they did through that action. Why was that $2.5 trillion at that point not inflationary? Because of the deflationary motion of the economy in general, which itself was because the economy had overinflated. When the situation from, say, 2000 to 2008, you look at that, that was a very, very inflationary period for especially the housing market. All that the action of the federal government did, both the $800 billion TARP bailout and the other programs, plus the extensive quantitative easing and other programs by the Federal Reserve, it did its best to prevent those assets from deflating in price. And it failed, but it didn't fail to such an extent that those prices cratered. The lowest they got was this, you know, chunk off of their peaks. And it was significant, but it was maybe 25-30%. They needed to have dropped 50-60-70% based on the inflation rates that we were seeing to have found a true bottom, if you were going to let the deflation take its course and really soak the people who had put a lot of money into it. And it would have destroyed a lot of banks. And we were not willing to let those banks go under. We were not letting those specific banks go under. And we weren't willing to let bondholders get the flush down the toilet there too, because that's what would have happened. And would that have been worse? Would the economy have tanked for longer? When we look at the Great Depression, we didn't have a lot of these same kind of mechanisms in place. And the pain went on for a decade. You know, the Great Recession was a decade of pain, but it was not on the same level as the Great Depression. Was it because this time around the pain was less severe to start with? Or was the medicine that we were taking actually somewhat successful? Those are questions that are difficult to answer.
And that's why you're a Keynesian.
I still disagree.
All right. Does anyone else have any other topics, or should I give one more?
Hit us, Paul.
Taylor. All right. So one thing that again, coronavirus related, sorry, it's top of mind for obvious reasons.
What is not coronavirus related? I mean, don't say sorry. Everything is coronavirus related right now, because the world is just completely it's embroiled in the coronavirus situation. There's no story that is not coronavirus right now in some way.
I was going to say I could give you a mostly non-coronavirus related. It could be politics. But that's even coronavirus related too, because we'd be touching on how Joe Biden isn't campaigning because he's, you know, 80 years old and probably would die if he saw anybody else.
What? We did a good job avoiding coronavirus when we talked about Game Pass.
Hey. Yeah, the Game Pass is largely not coronavirus related. So the idea, I've seen a lot of government officials talk about how you know, not one life should be sacrificed to boost the economy, and the kind of idea that we prioritize public health over all else, basically. And that, to me, seems like an overly simplistic reading of the situation, where in almost every other aspect of life, we make a reasonable trade-off between safety and, I don't want to say convenience, because that seems to trivialize it, but I mean, if we had that same mentality, like, you know, not one single loss of life is worth this trade-off, then we would never let people drive on a road. We would never let people have swimming pools in their backyard. We would let them have bathtubs in their house.
You'd never fly.
Flying, ironically, one of the safer methods of transportation. But this, yeah, the same idea. Like, I think the government even has, like, actuarial tables or whatever, which put a cost on human life and what is worth the trade-off and whatnot. I think we need to have the adult discussion that a certain number of lives are probably worth a trade-off of this is the kind of conversation that we have to have as states or as local governments or as federal governments. And that doesn't seem like people are having, for lack of a better term, the adult conversation of, yeah, some people are going to die. Like, it's going to happen. And we can't just wait until, like, it's 100% safe. And the irony of me saying that is that...
If it ever is 100% safe.
Yeah.
That's the specter lurking there, is it might never be that.
Yeah. And the irony of me saying this is that I am the person who, if you ask, like, the philosophical question of, would you kill some one innocent person in order to save like a million people from cancer or something like that, I would without doubt say no, I would not do that. And it's an interesting, like you said, it's an interesting version of the trolley problem there.
Did you say you would not spend $1 million to save a single person?
No, I said I would not kill one person.
Okay.
If you could kill one person to
I heard to I heard the cancer. Opposite. I heard that you wouldn't save the person for the $1 million.
Yeah, I will not kill a million people to save one person. Yep. I'm like one of those absolutists where it's like, if you could kill somebody to get the cure for cancer, like, then no, that's not right. It's not ethically right to do. And yet I'm also arguing here that, like, yeah, some people are going to have to die of coronavirus to open up the economy, because those are the kind of tough practical decisions that have to be made. Discuss.
If we open up the economy, people will die of coronavirus. If we do not open up the coronavirus, mm-hmm. people will die.
Open up the economy. Open up the
if we do not open up
the people will die of the economy.
If we do not
open what? I think that's his point, actually, getting here. If we don't open up the economy, people will die of lack of the economy, basically.
That's also true. And if we do not open up the economy, people will still die of coronavirus, is also the point. The question is, how many fewer? And if you want to do a true comparison, you do have to put an actuarial table on the value of a human life. And this has been done. And if you say, okay, if we are successful in contracting the number of deaths overall and reducing the speed of deaths due to coronavirus through contracting the economy, is the number of lives saved economically worth the cost to the economy? And believe it or not, the answer is yes, it is. Because the value of a human life in those actuarial tables is very high.
Because, well, let me ask you this. Is it worthwhile, even if you account for the fact that the age of the people that are dying tends to skew older?
Now you're just being a bastard.
Hey, that's my job.
So I don't have a control for that, because the actuarial tables that I'm looking at for these kinds of calculations, I'm going to send you an article and we may put it into the notes, because I spent a lot of time reading through this. It's not the best article in the world. It's on Wired.com thinking about this and talking about this. But if a person who is 75 dies, it is less economically impactful than if someone who is 25 dies, because the 25-year-old is still producing in the economy. However, for the actuarial tables, what we're looking at is the value of the human life, and that is not changed by the age, because the 75-year-old isn't producing, maybe, but still provides value to the economy in the form of, you know, family, friends, relatives, etc., on average, that is still worth just as much as the 25-year-old, regardless of the ethical implications. The ethical implications, of course, is that every life is equal, and the age of the person dying doesn't matter. And the fact is that the coronavirus deaths, yes, are skewing slightly higher, but it's not the really, really old. 80-year-olds and 90-year-olds are dying of coronavirus, but not at the same rate as 50, 60, 70-year-olds are dying. And surprisingly, a very high percentage of 30 to 40-year-olds are dying. Partially because that age range has a lot of people who are working in positions where they're going to contract it. It has more to do about the infection rates in those age ranges than it does about whether or not they're successful in fighting it.
Do you want me to really play the bastard here?
Sure, go for it.
I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to push back on the idea that ethically, the life of a 75-year-old is the same as the life of a 25-year-old. Because I will submit that the life of the 25-year-old has presumably many more years of life ahead of them. And the life of a 75-year-old, presumably far fewer years ahead of them. And to give a ridiculous scenario, you have like a 115-year-old who probably is going to die within the next couple of years, if not next couple of months anyway. It's hard to argue that they have the same, that their life has the same ethical value as a 18, what would be the prime of life, like 21-year-old or something like that, or and even in like an 8-month-old or something like that. And I'm going to stress here that I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm not necessarily advocating this argument, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about.
It's an interesting point, and here is the thing, bastard.
Yes.
We mentioned the trolley problem already, so let's take it as a specific, explicit example in the scenario that you're talking about. You have the trolley on the track pointed at the 25-year-old. If you take,
I don't like this, where this is going.
If you take no action, the 25-year-old is going to die. You have the choice whereby you can flip the switch, because that's the only thing you can do. You can't get help. It's too happening too fast, etc. All the things of the trolley problem. If you flip the switch, though, and you can change the track, you will save the 25-year-old and switch it to the track. But on that track is the 75-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Is it morally ethical for you to flip the switch?
I generally, on the trolley problem, because I've thought a lot about these, and I don't really have a super consistent answer, but I generally err towards inaction.
Correct.
Because the action,
because you're not that much of a bastard,
feel responsible.
You're 100%. You're not that much of a bastard. If you take,
well, I was actually going to say that in your first example, but you know, killing one person to find the cure for cancer or whatever your example was. There's also a vast difference of, are you the one literally killing that person versus, you know, even just giving the order to do so. You know, it is a different scenario. That's why the trolley is such a interesting scenario, because you're the one in charge.
And that's what I typically hang my hat on, is I typically will look at which one will am I most responsible for.
Correct.
Or will feel most responsible for.
This is actually very good reasoning, believe it or not, guys, because what what you're talking about is the idea of cooperation with evil. Are you willing to do an evil thing if it might have some benefit? But the fact is, you're doing evil. You are choosing to kill someone in order to have a good outcome. And when you do that, that is cooperation with evil, even if it is for the right reason. We are never permitted to cooperate with evil. And there's two different kinds of cooperation with evil. There is the immediate and full cooperation with evil, like the trolley problem that I just laid out for you, where you pull the switch and you kill the 75-year-old to save the 25-year-old, and it's 100% immoral, 100% of the time. And then there's the...
Wow, you could put a percentage on it. That's
100%.
Okay.
As opposed to the, it's evil, but maybe you get some leeway with it, of the proximate cooperation with evil, which includes things where you are saying, making the decision, we need to do this thing in order to save lives, and the consequences of those decisions will kill somebody, but you are not saying we're going to kill somebody, but there is no way that your decision doesn't kill somebody. Right? That is a cooperation with evil as well, but it is abstracted. You're not saying kill that person, kill a person, kill people. You're saying do this thing, and this bad thing also happens at the same time in order to get a good.
So what would you do? Both in terms of, well, I guess we know the answer for the trolley problem.
Trolley problem is super easy. You never flip the switch. Never.
Never flip the switch. Interesting.
The only time you flip the switch is if it's flipping the switch puts it on a track that doesn't kill somebody.
Interesting. Okay. I have to think about that, because I'm pretty sure I can come up with an answer that you'll say that you'll disagree with that on. But I have to think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to liken it. Yeah. It's not quite the same, but it almost seems like the people that said they were just following orders type of thing. Like, well, you know, I was just following orders. It's like, well, I was just in the trolley.
I mean, if I want to really take us down the rabbit hole and completely get us away from what I was originally talking about, it could be going back to, and I think I posed this question to you before because I found it interesting, the idea of like a tray of what fertilized eggs, is that what it was? Like if you're in a burning building and there are like, there's a room full of babies and they're like a tray of fertilized eggs, which one would you save?
Oh yeah, I remember this discussion, right. And the fertilized eggs are, you know, we're talking about human eggs, by the way, just to be very clear.
Yeah, it's like you could say like 100 fertilized eggs or like
one baby,
four babies, whatever right. You can carry. Like, which one would you do? And I think most people would say
the baby for sure, right? People would say
it's really hard not to choose the babies,
right?
Well, I'm just thinking of
Travis. Like, no, I wouldn't save either.
What on?
Travis is the real bastard.
Screw them all.
I set the fire.
I think. Well, I was just thinking,
like, in practicality, you save the babies because there's no guarantee that even fertilized eggs are gonna get to a baby, right? Because you still have to implant them and like get them to actually not have a miscarriage. Blah blah. Like, there's other reasons that the fertilized eggs aren't it's a bird in hand is worth two in the bush type of thing.
Yeah,
I'm just interested in hearing the 100% baby moral versus immoral from Andrew.
Well, this one doesn't have a 100% moral immoral situation because there is no. What's my default action? The default action is nothing, right? Well,
stay in the house and burn with the babies.
You know,
so in this case, it would be the trolley is going to run over like a cart full of babies, or you can flip the switch and have it run over like a tray full of fertilized eggs.
Yeah, in that case, inaction is correct. I would let the trolley hit the babies.
All right.
Because
I failed.
Each of those fertilized eggs at the moment of conception is a person. And if I say, okay, I'm going to let those people die because of my action, that is cooperation with evil. And that is, yeah, I think that I would take a lot of flack for that if that was actually a thing that would happen. I think I would be roundly accused of all kinds of bad things by most people, and I would take it. I would take it because they're wrong.
I think I would accuse the person that put the babies on the track.
Which it sounds like it was you, Travis. You set the fire.
That's the question of this trolley question is, really, who's the person that put the items on the tracks to begin with? They're the immoral one.
And the answer is usually something along the lines of God. We're just trying to hypothesize these things.
Right, yeah, right, so. I know it's subverting the entire trolley situation to ask that question. But then again, I liked The Last Jedi, so apparently I'm all about
subversion. Wait, The Last Jedi. Which one was that again? Is that the fourth one or the ninth?
It's the eighth one.
Eighth one, right. That one was shit.
Everyone agrees it was, except for Travis. To bring up the media you're consuming, I think our first one, The Good Place had an episode on the trolley problem.
Yeah,
for anybody
I haven't gotten there yet. That's my go-to.
Every time I think of the trolley problem, now I think of The Good Place.
It was a good episode on it too. Yeah.
One thing related to what we're talking about opening up the economy is there was because Maryland changed stay at home to safer at home, and like more businesses were allowed to, like, I can actually go get my comic books and games curbside. Still can't go in, but they're slowly opening up stuff. And then there was a headline, I believe today, about we just had like the highest case of positive tests like in a single day ever for the whole thing, and they were trying to link it to the then they say like days after the economy is starting to reopen. I'm like, I don't think those people got sick over the weekend if they're already testing positive. Like, they're probably not gonna, those people that got sick over this weekend are not probably even gonna be going to get tested for at least another week. So I don't know what you guys were maybe talking about, accusations against how light you were on the media or something, if that was, maybe that was all fair. But yeah, I found that to be a bad move on the media of trying to have headlines that are linking events that probably aren't linked.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of examples, and I won't get into it too much, but of the media not being very responsible with, and it's tough because I love to make fun of the media because they're so bad at their jobs in so many ways, and it certainly seems like in some ways they have an agenda here. And yes, the number of positive cases could go up because testing could be going up. Who knows? I don't know if they addressed that in the article.
They did say also that it was like the highest number of negative tests in the same day or something. Exactly. Which just proves that, yeah, more people are being tested. Yeah.
So, I mean, it could be, maybe the article was responsible and the headline was just a catchy headline. Who knows? A lot of times article writers like to make fun of the headline writers as like, I didn't write the headline, like, but it needed to sell papers.
Because I don't even know if the article was trying to make that link or if it was just the headline that was trying to draw a line of like, oh, look, the governor started reopening stuff and now there's more cases. Well, not within that time frame.
And there's another, I saw something else where they were comparing like Florida and New York. And if you were to follow most of the mainstream media, I think it's safe to say you'd be hearing about like, oh, like how brave Governor Cuomo has been, like, you know, pleading with, we need more ventilators, and they're doing everything they can, and they're doing such a good job of locking down everything, and stupid, irresponsible Republican governor of Florida is opening the beaches, and how could he when, like, with coronavirus? And if you look at the numbers, and again, I'm not trying to say that it's hard to disentangle cause and effect, right? Like, New York, there's clearly a lot of good reasons why New York had a lot of problems, and Florida might not have as many problems. But it's hard to justify all those negative articles written about Florida and all the positive coverage of New York when you look at the numbers and be like, wow, New York had a really big problem here.
And I think Americans are notoriously bad at geography, and I think we sometimes forget how much bigger the United States is than most other countries.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you sure compare it to South Korea and like that they can do certain thing. They did certain things that could lock it down. Everything. They're also like what, the size of a single state, right?
Oh well, it depends on the state. They're smaller than most of the states.
Right. Yeah. So, like, yeah, to your point, like things are going to be much different in Florida versus New York versus California versus Wyoming.
Yeah, exactly. And there's plenty of evidence that in the United States, things will go in waves. New York might be on the downswing now, thankfully, but there are still other states where maybe the things have just started. There is one where I think Virginia has not plateaued or tapered off yet, for whatever reason. I don't know what the reason is, but we are one of, I think, five or six states where I think the trend line is still up in terms of positive cases or I don't know exactly what metric they were using, but the idea was basically that most of the states in the United States have seem like they have flattened the curve and are on the downswing, except for Virginia and some others.
It also sounds like flattening the curve and all that stuff, people might be using different metrics, because the reason Hogan started reopening Maryland was hospitalizations were going down. I don't think they ever said even positive tests or anything were going down. It was just that the fact that there was less stress on the hospitals, they said. But even then, they said the restrictions were different by county. And I think the same thing was in Virginia, right? Like the four counties in Maryland that still had the higher rates are the more metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. The western half of the state is way more spread out and rural than Montgomery County, Baltimore County, Howard County, Montgomery County. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it completely makes sense to treat this probably on as local a level as possible, because the metropolitan areas, they're going to have a tougher time of it than the rural areas in general. Not necessarily like always. Obviously, metropolitan areas could have a stronger healthcare system than rural areas, so they might be able to handle it better. But it's different.
That has been one of the most interesting things for me, is just the ire that many of my leftist friends have had about the response of the federal government, trying to say, well, the federal government hasn't had a good response to this. You know, thank goodness my governor, Cuomo or Brown or whoever, is doing a good job for my state, because, man, I just can't trust the federal government right now to do the right job because, well, what they're saying is because Trump's in charge. But frankly, whoever was in charge of the federal government would not have been able to do a good job on a federal level, because the federal level is so broad for this country as to be meaningless. The governor and the mayors, frankly, are the ones who are going to be the ones to have the most success in implementing a policy that has some meaning. So Ron DeSantis applies in Florida the measures that are most important to protecting the most vulnerable in Florida. He is very proud of the fact that he has taken great steps to protect individuals in his nursing homes, which there are a lot of in Florida because there's a lot of old people in Florida retired down there. Whereas in New York, he's pointing out, DeSantis is, quite rightfully, that Cuomo did a terrible job in protecting his nursing homes. But, you know, to Cuomo's credit here, it's not like Cuomo had a lot of choice in the matter. People were being put into the nursing homes that had coronavirus because they were required to by law. You know, he was stuck. His hands were tied. And those laws were written for a good reason, but not in the coronavirus time mindset in mind. So DeSantis has a lot more freedom and is able to protect people that he thinks are more vulnerable. And in the long run, it's probably going to look pretty good from all this. And so is Cuomo. I think Cuomo's doing an okay job. But the people in the immediate area dealing with it, subsidiarity, the local level, has the highest chance of actually doing some good in protecting the local people.
Well, I think, not to fully support the leftist friends, but like Trump kind of did it to himself by constantly flip-flopping. Like one day he has complete authoritarian control to tell everybody what to do. The next day he's like, oh, no, I'm going to leave it to the governors. The next day, oh, but you have to keep your meat plants open. So, like, I think that's where some of the frustration from at the federal level has come from, is the inconsistency.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. He has claimed he has complete control, which is laughable. He doesn't, but he's claimed it, and then he was immediately pushed back on by the same governors who are saying, you know, please give us more aid. But then he comes in and says, yeah, you need to keep the meat plant, and he's able to do that because he does have that authority. He can declare something a critical infrastructure based on War Powers Acts. So he's allowed to do that, but should he be doing it? That's a fair question. And right, should he be giving better guidance?
Yeah. Well, I was just saying, the fact that you said it's the War Powers Act, like, should that be extended to non-war? But
yeah, and I think there's some other things that he has. The president, for, you know, as much as he is a figurehead in a lot of things, has over time been given a ridiculous level of power by Congress, because Congress didn't want to have to make those decisions and take those votes. So it's in the president's hands now, frequently. But yeah. even then, we're a federalist system. We have states that are sovereign, not the federal government.
Right. But even the states can be conflicted, because I don't remember if I brought this up last time or not, that one of the state delegates was, I think, trying to sue Hogan by saying he didn't have the power to make these like face mask mandates and stay at home orders and everything, because they said, no, that's the state Congress's job. The governor can't just make these decrees.
And he may well be right. I don't know Maryland's situation, but that is a reasonable position to have a political fight over. But the thing is, as a practical matter, it shouldn't be a fight. People who want to say, I shouldn't have to wear a mask, you can be right. You can be 100% right that you have a right not to wear a mask, and you should be allowed to do whatever you want not wearing a mask. But at the same time, it's really stupid to take that as your point. Is that the hill you want to die on? Is that really any benefit in this situation? Put the damn mask on. It doesn't do you any harm. Just do it.
Yeah, I'm very torn on this issue, because as a libertarian, I see all this, what appears to be executive, whether it's from the president or governors or whatever, overreach in terms of kind of unilaterally just, and in many cases arbitrarily seemingly, saying, oh, we got to shut down these businesses and these businesses are essential. And I would love to see a lot of pushback legally in terms of the constitutionality or the legality of those orders. At the same time, as somebody who thinks that this is a major concern and a major problem, and that people should be staying home as much as possible and socially distancing and everything, I don't want to see a lot of people disobeying those orders. Like, well, so I'm kind of torn. I'd like to see a lot of people saying, like, no, you don't have that authority, but everyone should stay home just in case.
It's not a, the governor says you must do this. This is a, guys, it's common sense. Do this.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and even stuff like, I think on the highways up here, they had that you, if you came back from New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, you were supposed to quarantine. Well, no one's literally enforcing that. They're just trying, they're just saying, like, you should. Mm-hmm. So I think some people are trying to treat everything like that about the face masks and everything, like, no, like, that's, you know, I don't have to just because you told me to.
And sure. That's why I don't take a lot of great joy from the, like, that Costco video of the guy, which I, for the record, I haven't watched.
I watched it without the sound on, so it's probably, it was pretty useless. Yeah. So that's why I wound up scrolling through the Twitter comments to try to glean what the video is actually about.
Yeah, I mean, by all accounts, I think I did the same thing. I looked at some of the comments. By all accounts, the guy was being an asshole and an idiot, and I'm perfectly happy to accept that. But to me, it's not an interaction I want to see, right? No. Like, I would love it if there were no rules that you had to wear a face mask, but at the same time, I'd love it if everyone did wear a face mask. That's the kind of, like, voluntary thing, society and action that I would like to see. I don't want the government to tell me that you are not allowed to have your business open. I want people to be like, no, it's probably a good idea to not have our business open right now, and you know, not have people sitting in our restaurants shoulder to shoulder and spreading viruses. Well, it's a no-win situation for me.
I mean, it's not really catch 22, but it's the eternal conundrum of libertarianism, right? Is like, your rights extend all the way until they infringe on somebody else's rights.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of the hard point of it. And, like, with this is, like, you could not, with the masks thing specifically, we've said, you might be sick, not have symptoms, and get somebody else sick. Well, therefore, you hurt their freedom, kind of, if you want to use that word.
Yeah, the idea of, should, in a libertarian society with a non-aggression principle, should you be required to wear a mask in a situation like this? It's a really interesting philosophical debate about, are you aggressing somebody by potentially sneezing, coughing, whatever germs that they could inhale by not wearing a mask? Or are they infringing on your rights by making you wear a mask?
There's also, yeah, in the voluntarism side of it, who is doing the enforcing? Right. If mm-hmm. if it's a private business, private property, if you're on you're coming to my house and I say you have to wear a mask, then that's perfectly okay. If it's the business, Costco says you have to wear a mask. I don't know this video that you're talking about, but I know similar situations, I'm sure. If Costco is saying you have to wear a mask to come in and shop in our shop, then that they are permitted to do so because it's a voluntary thing. If you don't want to wear the mask, you don't have to go in the shop. If you want to buy the stuff in the store, then put the damn mask on. And if you don't want to do that, go to the store that doesn't have that requirement.
Right. I mean, it was a funny example, but that foul language comic about, you know, they're not going to like the store's pants policy. In a way, it's totally in line with
100%. So who is doing the enforcement matters. When it's the government doing the enforcement, that's when we start to have some issues for a lot of libertarians, because the government probably shouldn't have that authority. Because once the government has that kind of level of authority, many libertarians, myself included, tend to think that that authority will be abused in some capacity, because that's what governments do. When the government has authority, they tend to abuse it. Should people be wearing masks? Yes. But it should be because it's the right thing to do, not because the government has told them that that's the right thing to do. When the government's – I will also say just to take this completely away from coronavirus for a second, I remember reading about a situation where marijuana was becoming legalized in a number of states, and two friends were having a discussion about this, and one was a frequent marijuana consumer already, didn't care that it was against the law, and the other was one who said, well, it's against the law, so therefore I'm not going to participate. But now that it was becoming legalized, he felt that that made it okay. It was no longer for him a moral thing, because the state was the moral authority. Rather than the individual or the person's faith in church, the state government became the moral authority. For people in those situations who put that much faith, and I do mean that word faith, in the government, in the state, they need the government to be saying these things. Because if the government isn't saying those things, then the person and entity to which they've entrusted their faith is letting them down.
It's getting a little late, so I don't necessarily want you to answer this, but do you think that the there is a correlation? And with that, I'm going to ask a question anyway.
There must be a lag.
Do you think the correlation between a general decrease in the religiosity, is that a word? The religiousness
of
people over the past, I don't know, decades, century, and maybe an increase in faith in government have a correlation, a relationship?
Absolutely, they do. If you want to read more about this, I highly recommend a book called The Righteous Mind. I'm blanking on the economist's name who wrote it, but it's a very interesting book. A little lengthy. He goes on a couple of diatribes and different directions. He's himself fairly liberal, but he is understanding of conservative points, and so talks about them and tries to explain them to people who may be liberal and having trouble understanding conservative points. So if you find yourself to be liberal and have trouble understanding conservative points, this is something that's probably really good for helping you understand that. The Righteous Mind identifies religiosity as one of those things that really drives people, and we all have religion. We can be atheist and still have religion. There's something that we put our faith in, and it could be ourselves, it could be the government, it could be a church, but we are baked in and have an innate human need to believe in something greater than ourselves, right? That's the basic understanding of religion. If that person or thing that is greater than yourself is God, that's pretty straightforward. But if that person or thing that is greater than yourself is the collective government, then that's a different thing. But they both point to elements of religiosity.
So what I'm hearing is that I have another link to put in the show notes.
Yep, I'll put it up for you.
All right. Yeah,
you might be able to link back to our discussion about your money or your life, because I'm fairly certain somewhere in there is a snippet about, from the book, about the deterioration of religious aspects in people's life has had to been filled with something, but I'm drawing a blank on if that something was just capitalism or something, you know, consumerism or something like that, but I forget what. But yeah, there was a point to that in I think in Your Money or Your Life.
Well, the nitpicker in me can't help but point out that at some point Andrew was saying that everyone has faith in something, even if it might be just yourself, and then mere seconds later, he said, we all have to believe in something that's greater than ourselves. And
sure,
so I feel like there's a little bit
things of
a conflict there. That if you,
I need some time to think about that one, and probably fewer beers to think about that one. I said that one as I'm flowing. You got me flowing.
Yeah.
Or more beers.
Yeah, I got
more beers is the answer. More beers is always the answer.
I thought I had read, yeah, like at the entrance to every Freemason's hall, there's like something that says you have to believe in some higher power. It doesn't have to be God. It can be whatever your choice of higher power is. So if that's pure physics, it is. Although it turns out the Freemasons really want you to believe in God, I guess. So. But
it doesn't have to be God, but it should be God.
Well, Freemasons do want you to believe in God. It's just a very specific God, so.
All right, well, that sounds like as good a place as any to wrap us up. We've been going on for over an hour, probably, depending on how we splice this.
Our connection's starting to fail
anyway. Well over that. I'm sure the people that tuned in for Gamer Pass were fascinated by Keynesian economics.
This was Grab Bag. People tuned in for Grab Bag. They got Grab Bag.
It's a diverse...
Better than grab
diversity
ass
of thought,
that's right.
Variety of opinion. I can't remember what our motto is.
We should have printed it on our shirt.
We should have. Hey, I'm wearing mine. Is everyone? All right.
Andrew? Nope. He's holding up. He's wearing his undershirt for us, I think.
Boo. All right. Well, that's riveting audio right there. All right. Well, so check us out at rampantdiscourse.com. Check out, visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/rampantdiscourse. We have a Discord
soon
channel
to be nationalized.
Soon to be nationalized and taxed out of existence. We have a Discord channel at discord.io
to pay for your universal basic income.
Check us out on Twitter at Rampant Disc. And am I missing anything else? I don't think I am.
That's good enough.
All right,
but come join us on the Discord and tell us where you feel about some of these things. So that'll be fun.
There you go. can't stop the discourse.